Sam. Hey, that was better synchronization than you and David have ever gotten, and we weren't even trying, Tim. I think his days are numbered as a blogging head. I think we now know what the problem has been.
Oh, he'll be crushed anyway.
Yeah, I know. And what's he going to do for income after this? So, how you doing, Jim?
I'm fine, thanks. And you?
I'm okay. How's Washington, D.C.?
Well, as the joke around here goes, nobody here has gotten laid off. Nobody here got a budget cut. Everybody here got a huge increase. So
yeah.
The mood is jolly, or even imperial, shall we say.
Yeah, and you have some issues with the way the money is being distributed in the course of this this attempted recovery from, right?
I mean, I just think this is the biggest heist.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Some issues, yeah.
Since the Grant administration, and that was a lot less money, even in real terms, involved. I am flabbergasted. Maybe you can explain this to me, why Democrats are presiding over the greatest upward shift of income in the history of the United States, at least.
Jim, I'd be happy to explain that to you. But okay. First, are you sure it is the greatest
upward shift? I'm positive it is. I mean, if you read, you know, Jeffrey Sachs's piece about this new plan for, you know, guaranteeing the losses of every big hedge fund in the country, I mean, it's just astonishing.
Like deposit insurance for hedge funds, kind of.
Yeah, but with unlimited upside. It was in the Huffington Post yesterday, and that's Jeffrey Sachs on top of George Stiglitz, on top of Paul Krugman. I mean, you can say what you want, and I'll sit still for an economic discussion saying that this is the right way to stimulate the economy, although I don't really believe it. But that part you can at least argue about. What you can argue about is that this is going to turn millionaires into billionaires and probably billionaires into trillionaires.
Well, I guess, first of all, I would say, I mean, is it whether Obama is presiding over what will on balance be this huge upward shift of income, there is the fact that in his budget, he actually wants to raise taxes on affluent people, right?
So did Clinton, and the income. I mean, but the difference between Obama and Clinton is that Clinton wasn't busy writing checks in the hundreds of billions of dollars to the same people he was going to raise their taxes slightly for.
Yeah. Okay. So
I'm not detecting a lot of enthusiasm for this mission here of defending Obama, although I'm sure you think you're supposed to in terms of the big scheme of things.
Well, I mean,
he is, after all, a Bill Clinton-type Democrat, just exaggerated, right? And Bill Clinton, we all know Bill Clinton was the highest form of political development. Right, Bob?
Okay.
Right, non-zero and all that?
Well, he did have good taste in books, yes. the highest form of literary development. Well, I'm kind of speechless. I mean, I don't know as much about all of this stuff as I should, I guess. I certainly agree that more rich people should have taken haircuts than have taken them, in general.
I mean, here, Bob, I can think of three ways to create jobs. Okay, bear with me here. Three ways.
Mm-hmm.
One way is the free market, which I suspect you and I would agree is the best way in the scheme of things. All right. Mm-hmm. Second thing is have the government hire people. And I'm more dovish on that idea, if need be, just because it obviously works. If you want to, you know, I think the Civilian Conservation Corps and the WPA, given the circumstances of the Depression, were a good idea. And the third way to do it is to have the government give zillions to banks and then hope they lend it to somebody and then people get hired.
Yeah.
I mean, you would agree with me that the third way is certainly the most circuitous and certainly the most trickle-down-ish. And, of course, if the banks give the money to China or India, as they did in the case of Bank of America and J.P. Morgan and Citigroup, mm-hmm. all of whom did multi-billion-dollar deals, then there's zero stimulus whatsoever, just simply a transfer of money from the taxpayers and unborn generations to current fat cats.
There's a couple of things going on there. I mean, as for the money going overseas, that's a general problem with stimulus in a highly globalized era, I would say. However you do the stimulus, some money goes, you know, most ways you're going to do it, some money goes.
Now, what if you just said, we're creating jobs here in Alabama or North Dakota?
Yeah.
What if you just did that?
You can. There is some of that in the stimulus package, as for the bank bailout, I would say there is a. I think you're oversimplifying the function of it in a way. The as a means of creating jobs in a tangible way, I don't know, but I don't think that was the only point of it. And I mean, first of all, I think you would probably agree that we're basically talking about the Bush/Obama approach, right?
Yes, we are.
The bailout started during Bush, And I will say that one thing that didn't happen after the Bush bailout that might have happened and that people were afraid would happen was a chain reaction of bank failures, okay? We don't know that that would not have happened in the absence of the bailout package.
What did they do in the Depression when they had bank failures? They closed the banks.
This to last as long as the Depression lasted?
No, I don't. But I'm saying there's two choices on a busted bank. One is close it, pay off the depositors, not the shareholders, not the bondholders, but the depositors. Mm-hmm. And then the other is do what the Japanese did, which is simply write a check every couple months for a bunch of money to keep the bank open as a quote zombie unquote. And it's clear that Geithner and Paulson, both of them, are unanimous in the view that it's much better to simply pay off zombie banks, at it indefinitely, than to actually wrestle with the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I completely agree. I'll say it for the record: Paulson and Geithner are the same person. They are both moles for Wall Street down here in Washington.
There has been a certain continuity of philosophy, I would say, without any doubt. I will say, though, that if you were going to defend the whole approach, I mean, you would say two things. I mean, look, it seems to me the situation we were in as of the fall was we had gotten ourselves into a situation that was sufficiently bad that recovery had to entail a certain amount of pain because we had bought into a bubble that was bound to burst in the process. We had built up way too much debt. And there was going to be no painless way out. Now, what you would like to do, though, the pain you would like to avoid is the unnecessary pain that can be a result of panic, right? And so, like, chain reaction, financial failure, intertwined with ever-plummeting stock market, that part of it is not intrinsic to the solution of the problem, and you would like to avoid that. Now, I do think you could argue that whether or not the bank bailouts have done what you'd like, and let me stop here and add parenthetically, I have heard from a number of people, not only an ideologically diverse group of economists, say that they think that early on, and to some extent even now, the policy has been premised on a mistaken emphasis on the component of the problem that was about a credit crunch, right? Or the availability of credit, right? In other words, there's increasingly people are kind of saying the problem actually isn't that banks won't lend so much as that there are a lot of people who just no longer want to borrow, okay? So, let me kind of bracket that parenthetically,
Bob?
Yeah.
I think liberals are going to have a hard time defending this.
I think probably not. I think probably not, because I think in the end, there's only going to be one thing that matters. I mean, people are sufficiently... People got to a point of sufficient fear of an actual depression that if this turns out to be something considerably less than that, then whoever the person is who is president, I think is going to be in pretty good shape politically.
And so you think that if there's just if a procession of AIG bonus issues, that the voters won't mind over the next 4 years?
I think if there is recovery, and again, to get back to what I was saying, I think a crucial part, I mean, the point of policy all along should have been to avoid the unnecessary pain that would be caused by panic and despair. And I'm going to hold up to this screen the front page of yesterday's New York Times, which shows two graphs. One is the number of people who say that the things are going in the right direction. And there you see that during Obama's tenure, I mean, there's been a considerable increase in confidence, whereas the number of people who say the economy is getting worse, is dropping, better, is rising. And this is all during the Obama era. And I think that is to a great extent. I mean, you know, it's a cliche. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. But that is a lot of what we had to fear. And if these two, and the fact is that both of the big kind of bailouts, in other words, when Congress passed the, that however many, you know, billions of dollars of, what was it, during the Bush administration, that big rescue plan, the TARP thing, they finally planned. Okay, and then when Geithner finally rendered a clear version of his plan, both of those times, as I recall, the stock market, the effects on the stock market were good. And that
but
is,
Bob,
I think,
any idiot can make the stock market go up. You just give them money. You can write checks and make these guys make the stock market go. Now the money won't be worth anything in the long run. What you can't do is increase jobs that way, because you won't get the people who are benefiting from higher stock prices to hire people.
Jim, I'm about
unemployment is rising. Have you noticed that? Isn't it strange? Go ahead.
I'm about to address you as an employee of Rupert Murdoch, which you in some sense are, right?
I am.
When the market got down to about 6,600, the Wall Street Journal, owned by Rupert Murdoch, and I must say appreciably more sensationalistic since he took it over, but whatever, had a huge headline saying Dow could well drop to 5,000. Now, apparently, the people at the Wall Street Journal didn't think it was trivially easy to keep a panic selling.
Bob, it is trivially. It may be controversial. In other words, if you prop up the stock market at the expense of the overall economy, which is clearly what Obama's doing, Wall Street will be relieved. There'll be a sigh of relief from Church Street to Trinity Church on Wall Street. But what you won't get is recovery in the country. That's what's so astonishing about Obama's presidency. Why isn't he creating jobs? Why is he seeing it as his mission in life to keep the Wall Street Journal happy?
Give the man a couple more months. But I think we kind of disagree. I think the greatest fear is a psychological spiral downward, an integral part of which would be ongoing drop in the stock market. Because a fair number of people now have money in the market, whether retirement funds or whatever. And so as that drops, consumption drops, and the jobs that you're looking for either don't get created or get lost. There just is that kind of interaction.
I think this is a spectacular illustration of the trickle-down, which has completely captured the mind of thoughtful Democrats like yourself.
Well, thank you.
This is absolute. I mean, I can't think of a speech from the Chamber of Commerce that would sound more like what you just said. But I think that, as many economists have pointed out, I mean, and Rob Shapiro, to name one, that the link now between the stock market and Main Street has been broken. The link now between productivity and profits and people's wages has been broken. And now, I'm sure Tom Donahue at the Chamber is delighted, and for that matter, head of the New York Stock Exchange, are delighted to hear Bob Wright, thoughtful Clinton Democrat, saying, hey, isn't it great the market's going up? And by the way, unemployment, well, what about that? Who cares?
Actually, I'm not talking about it going up. I'm just talking about it not spiraling downward.
Okay, not spiraling downward.
And
I'm saying that you can print money and make the stock market go up. But what you can't do is print money and create jobs. What you can't do is print money.
You can print money and make the stock market go up, actually.
Yes, you can, because if credit's cheap, then people can borrow money and buy stocks.
Well, and they may or may not take the loans, they may or may not buy the stocks. All I'm saying, look, I am totally open to the idea that economic historians will look back and deem the bailout packages incredibly ham-handed. I don't know enough myself to judge, and of course a lot of the people who are criticizing them want something to the left of what you'd want, like nationalization of the banks. I don't know enough to decide among those people.
I'd nationalize. If a bank is busted, I'd nationalize it in a flash.
Okay, well, good.
And to say, look,
what I would say...
You made a mistake in investing in this bank, and you should fire the management, and you should hate the people who gave you advice to buy the stock, and don't do it again.
Yeah.
I think that's imminent. I mean, I think what's so striking is that again, I'm still struck by the phrase from Mark Schmidt a New America Foundation type and editor of the American Prospect, who last fall, before Obama was elected, was saying Obama's vision, or maybe it was last summer, Obama's vision is communitarian populism, which strikes me as actually kind of an oxymoron. But the point is, it's going to be everybody's going to get better off thanks to Obama. Well, I mean, now we know how that translates into.
Given the situation he inherited, you cannot expect some kind of massive recovery in the job market soon. I mean, give the guy a little time.
Actually, Bob, here's a question for you. What month of the Depression did unemployment hit its absolute peak? I happen to know this answer. This is not a trick question.
I don't even know enough to know what the obvious answer would be.
The answer is that unemployment peaked during the Depression in March of 1933. That was the month that Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in as our president, because back then presidents were inaugurated in March, not January.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what President Roosevelt did immediately was start giving people jobs. And, you know, guess what? The voters rewarded him for it.
So this is partly a critique of the stimulus package. You think the stimulus package, they should have found more shovel-ready jobs, as they
said. I think this is a critique of the entire vision that says that what matters most is maintaining the confidence of AIG.
Confidence in things like banks and money market funds, and confidence that your IRA is not going to get eroded further if you don't take your money out of the stock market. Those are the kinds of confidence I do think it was essential to. That job has been accomplished largely, however inefficient the approach, and I'm willing to believe it was horribly inefficient and even unjust.
But I think in a
crude sense, it has not failed.
The big asset that people have is not their 401k, it's their house. And isn't it interesting that Obama and Geithner and all his Wall Street, Goldman Sachs advisors who are telling what to do were much more focused on stock prices than real estate prices? Now,
they do have a mortgage program that actually some people think is in a certain sense too generous or too indiscriminately generous.
The mortgage program, I think, is $200 billion, and the Wall Street bailout is $12 trillion.
Yeah, but do you believe as a conservative that all the people who just did a stupid job of buying houses and bought into a bubble mindlessly, or bought into mortgages that if they thought about it they'd realize they couldn't sustain? Do you think all those people should be bailed out?
No, but I think they're a better candidate for bailouts than Wall Street financiers. And I also think, and I'm pretty darn sure as a matter of fact, that if you wanted to restore consumer confidence, you would give people the feeling that their house is worth a lot, and that's going to make them go out and actually buy things.
Yeah,
what's so striking about this is the consumption that Obama is stimulating is in Greenwich, Connecticut, not Springfield, Ohio.
But one thing you have to accept, it seems to me, if you have any degree of faith in markets, is that we were in a situation where house prices just had to fall. We had to get back to reality. The bubble had to burst eventually, and I don't think there's any way of getting around the fact that housing prices were going to fall. And in fact, my critique would, if anything, be do less intervening to save a bunch of middle-class homeowners some mortgage payments, and just have plenty of money left over for people who are truly unemployed. That's the best index of who needs help. If they can't eat, they need help.
What's so striking, again, and this is just the political science lesson here, is that just how thoroughly Wall Street has hypnotized the sort of the liberal intelligentsia in this country.
Look, I think you're basically...
You can't wait to dump on homeowners, but you're sitting here defending AIG and Goldman and Merrill Lynch.
I don't think you're listening to what I'm saying.
I am listening, but the scale here is important. $200 billion in a housing bailout versus $12 trillion for Wall Street. Now, and again, which gets you more worked up? The $200 billion for housing bailouts.
The $12 trillion? Where did that number come from?
That's the total amount of money that the government has sunk into various financial guarantees. It's a Googleable fact. $12 trillion.
But all of it is literally, all of it is going to Wall Street. None of it is actually going to help the people. It's
liquidity injections and the Federal Reserve and Treasury and all
this stuff. I think nobody would say it's all anywhere near all of it is going to Wall Street or even going to fat cats. Look, but let me be clear about what I'm saying. I'm not defending the details of the bailout. I'm saying, in a gross sense, It seems to have worked in forestalling the worst kind of panic. Beyond that, I'm sure there are a ton of things that could have been differently done differently. Certainly, and I agree that what, you know, this thing stinks the way, the extent to which the policymakers have been kind of in bed with Wall Street or coming from Wall Street, you know, beginning with Paulson and continuing, you know, on the way down. And I don't like the idea that Larry Summers, it turns out, made however much money.
$8 million.
Yeah. No,
why do you think they paid him $8 million last year, Bob?
You know, it's an interesting question because, as Noam Shiver pointed out on a dialogue, there couldn't have been the expectation that the guy was going to return to government because the thinking was his public career was over after he screwed up at Harvard, right? So it's hard for me to imagine him actually adding that much value working, what, one day a week? I mean, so I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Maybe they were just putting their chips on him. Maybe they did think he was going to come back.
If you were looking for a Larry Summers fan, I suggest you look elsewhere, okay? I don't think we're going to have a big argument about him.
I mean, my question, though, is I think Warren G. Harding deserves an upward rehabilitation because Warren G. Harding presided over a growing economy. Nobody disputes that. He was, you know, according to Teapot Dome and so on, a crook, and everybody hated him for being a crook.
Yeah.
And now, I guess the new rule is if the economy goes up, you can be a crook. Right, Bob?
If the economy goes up, you can be a crook. I'm not sure.
And the voters will forgive you. They didn't forgive Warren G. Harding, but are they going to forgive Obama?
Voters forgive a lot during a crisis. I would certainly say that it should not be the case that the Treasury Secretary is somebody who failed to pay his taxes. I mean, but this is the way things work. Is in a panic when everybody says, "No, wait, Geithner,
who
market
panic?
Went up when we appointed him."
Who was panicked last? Who was panicked? Were you panicked last September? Paulson was panicked. You know why Paulson
was
panicked? Because
he was
afraid Goldman Sachs was going to go under.
Yeah, well, that was a different source of panic.
That is right. That's a different sort of panic. But the point is the panic that Paulson put in Bush's ear, President Bush, 43, now speaks for the panic rest of you and I weren't panicked. We were concerned, but
they were panicked.
And they talked Bush into opening the Treasury door.
Yeah.
And then Bush left office, leaving Obama to keep shoveling out the trillions.
Well, I think human psychology is a little more complex than that. I don't think Paulson was thinking we're going to fool Bush into thinking there's a genuine crisis. I think he was convinced that he seems like a reasonably upstanding guy.
How can you say that?
When they let
Lehman Brothers go bankrupt. Happily
right.
So, and then, but AIG owed now, Goldman $20 billion, so they bailed out AIG.
Well, I just
think the CEO of Goldman Sachs in the room, according to the New York Times, that may have been
a corruption of Paulson's judgment. I just think corruption works subtly and largely unconsciously. So we don't, in a way, we don't disagree. But what do we disagree? I mean, what's interesting to me?
I think it stinks. I do agree with you. I mean, I want that. I hope that the blogging heads, high command. Edits this in such a way that we both agree that, quote, this stinks, unquote.
Have you ever seen editing happen at Blogging Heads, Jim? What? I think you're getting this mixed up with Fox News. Speaking of which, this is interesting to me, you've got a couple of things going on. Fox has apparently started some new thing called Fox Nation, which you're part of. I want to talk about that.
Okay.
I also want to locate you in conservative space. It's increasingly... Your populism has become a very prominent part of your conservatism. So I'm seeing you as a populist, nationalist, religious conservative. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah,
I'll
go there. Yeah.
Can you lay out the landscape for me in terms of, like, what percentage of the party does that represent at this point? Who are your big opponents? You know, David Frum is carving out some turf that's a little different.
David Frum is the gay marriage Republican.
He wants to be
environmental and be for gay marriage and sell that to the Republican Party.
I don't think he wants to be super environmental. He wants to certainly sound more moderate on both of those fronts.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how much of a chunk of the party like does he represent as opposed to what you represent?
I'll go with the American Spectator, which referred to him as a Branch Davidian Republican.
yeah, except without the craziness.
I will just say this: the bulk of the Republican Party out there in red state America is Christians and small businessmen and hunters and fishers and so on and so on, and they obviously have a certain set of pro-American, patriotic, conservative values that I think that Fox Nation, FoxNation.com, speaks to. I think that's sort of the common sense.
So would you say? I was wondering about this. I went to Fox Nation, and see, I apologize for not spending enough time watching Fox News to really know much about it, other than it's right of center, and was behind at least one war that I wasn't behind. But actually, that you weren't behind.
I was against it too.
Which leads me to kind of this question. I mean, is Fox Nation, A, does it correspond to what I just described, populist, nationalist, religious? And we actually haven't even gotten into foreign policy, but would you say it tracks onto that?
I think Fox Nation will be whatever the American people, the audience that Fox has and the Fox can attract, and I think it'll get much larger in the years to come.
That's scary to think that Fox Nation is growing.
I think that's, I mean, because they speak to, where the country is on it. I mean, why is it, as I read on Fox Nation this morning, that according to the Detroit Free Press, I mean, the beauty of Fox Nation is that it links to stories as they appear. The Detroit Free Press this morning reports that Detroit has 633,000 registered voters. Sounds reasonable, except that Detroit has 603,000, 30,000 less adults over the age of 18 in the city.
Mm.
Now, isn't that interesting?
It makes you suspicious, kind of.
Makes you suspicious. And again, if you see that, if you don't see that in the Washington Post or the New York Times or CNN or MSNBC, then you know the value of Fox News and you know the value of Fox Nation. I'm telling you, mm-hmm. these Tea Parties, coming up on April 15th, are going to be a stunner in terms of their quantity and enthusiasm. Again,
we have another Jim Pinkerton prediction on videotape.
We may revisit this.
It's not as quantitative as I would like. Do you want to predict the turnout?
No, I have no idea. I just know it'll be way bigger, and CNN and MSNBC and the New York Times and the Washington Post, and for that matter, the Beltway, and satellite beltways like Princeton, New Jersey, will be stunned when they realize how many people are really, really fired up over all this.
And what's the main thing?
Smug, big spending liberalism that's going on down here in Washington.
And so this is a protest against what? Size of budget, taxes, stimulus package?
Everything.
Everything. Yeah. It's against everything.
It's against everything that Washington is doing now.
Wow. Well, you could get a lot of people to oppose one or another of those things. So let me get kind of clear. And what is Fox Nation just technologically?
Was
a Fox website and your stuff appeared on it. So what's new?
Fox Nation is going to be an aggregator. It's going to be links, and it will soon have a dramatically expanded participation factor from ordinary Americans who want to be part of Fox Nation.
And if I say nice things about it, will they link to this part of this dialogue or embed it, do you think? Because I've always thought, I mean, you talk about somebody who has long been a fan of both Foxes and Nations, it doesn't get more enthusiastic.
So you're saying, but in your case, better red than dead, as in red state.
I'm saying better high traffic than low traffic, whatever it takes. So
I mean, we'll revisit this as time goes by, but I think Grover Norquist, well-known conservative activist, says that Fox Nation is going to do for the internet what Fox News did to cable.
Mm-hmm.
Be transformative, disruptive, and ultimately profoundly constructive. That was Grover's phrase.
So I should take a closer look.
You should take a closer look at as you think about issues like immigration and crime and how sort of the Beltway and, sort of says, well, these are issues that we'll get to after we get through something really important, like eliminating nuclear weapons around the world. And I think this, the Fox Nation will say, no, we think that these are you can't plant a serial killer in our midst or a sex offender back in our midst and get away with it. You just won't. And I think that's where the populist will overcome the elitist.
Okay, so back to this question of the struggle for the soul of the Republican Party. Okay, you've dismissed one contender as a branch Davidian, but you mentioned immigration. Well, right there you have a cleavage, as you know, which gets you into trouble with a certain amount of the business community in the Republican Party. So, I mean, who are the other players? I mean, surely the party is not entirely now populist nationalist.
No,
religious,
no, no.
Right? I mean, you've got the whole people with libertarian leanings.
Sure,
and
sure.
Are you going to just cut? You're willing to cut them all loose, and you think you can win an election?
I don't think so at all. I think just the opposite. In fact, I think that the Republican Party now, in opposition, is well advised to be a big tent, to coin a phrase. For lots of different strands of thinking, again, some of these things that Obama's doing. That, I mean, when he goes to Prague and says he wants to eliminate nuclear weapons, okay, and then the North Koreans greet that statement by firing off a rocket. Does any normal American, I'll just put the word as normal, think that a treaty of any kind to abolish nuclear weapons could ever be enforced or verified? Do you think it ever could be?
If you define a rocket as something that actually flies, the North Koreans didn't launch a rocket. But leaving that aside, my position has long been that I don't see the point of, I mean, maybe there's rhetorical value, but as an actual policy goal, I don't see the point of putting tremendous emphasis on the elimination of nuclear weapons. Someday, maybe.
Then why did Obama say it, do you think?
Well, people
like it.
He gave
a whole speech on
that. As I said, it may have some... here's kind of a good example, which is that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which I think at this point has frayed to the point of needing either radical revision or replacement, still was pretty effective for a few decades. And part of it was to posit as a long-term goal the complete elimination of nuclear weapons on the part of the United States and everybody, right? So... sometimes there is that kind of rhetoric, I think, has actual value, but as a policy goal, I have I could give you a number of objectives that are well short of elimination and I think are more important to focus on as a matter of policy.
How about missile defense?
I'm against missile defense.
You are?
Yeah.
Do you think it's a good idea for Israel to have missile defense? Or a bad idea?
Well, if Israel wants it, I mean, they can, they can do it.
Is it a good idea for Japan to have missile defense?
I'm opposed to it as a matter of American policy.
Why?
I think first of all, I think there's almost no chance it would work. I mean, if there's one thing life has taught me, it's that anything, you do of any complexity at all, if you can't test it in real-world conditions, right, if you can't beta test something in something like real-world conditions, the chances of it actually working are not good. And by definition, you can't test this in real world, because the real world conditions are years go by without anybody firing one of these things, and a lot, and finally it happens. And you can't do that in a test, and you don't know where it's going to come from, and blah,
so
blah, blah.
So how did we get anti-aircraft weapons, and how do we get those to work?
They're the definition of real life is just different. I mean, there isn't the role of the unexpected. I mean, they don't sit around for years without anything happening, and then finally the threat coming. Here's one big difference is, look, anti-aircraft weapons. I'm sure the first few times they use them in real life, they didn't work. That's my point. This is a different thing where if it doesn't work, you got a serious problem, okay?
Well, you're right. But if the North Koreans have missiles, what should we do about them? Nothing?
Right now, I don't see that as a huge problem. I mean, I will say something I said around the time of the Iraq Wars. If you had to invade one country back then, North Korea seems to be a much easier deal. I wouldn't do that now. But...
or 40 or 50 countries have ICBMs in a couple decades. Just sit there and say, okay, that's just the way the world is now?
No, I'd be doing much more radical things on the arms control front right now, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
But the Iranians aren't going to agree.
Well, we haven't tried anything interesting with them, it seems.
The Russians won't agree. The Chinese won't agree.
We don't know. Nobody's tried.
Well, we can't even get them to condemn the North Korean missile launch, which was against the UN rules. I mean, the point is, you're really saying, Bob, with a straight face, that you would, in a world where 30 or 40 or 50 countries have nuclear weapons, ICBMs and probably nuclear weapons too, that you will then, you'll still oppose missile defense?
Oh, at that point, I'm not sure I would. But what I'm saying is we're more likely to get to that dire situation if we emphasize missile defense and really think it's going to save us. Because it lulls us into complacency, it misdirects both our financial and our psychological resources, and it moves them away from what we should really be focusing on, which is non-proliferation.
The Pakistanis aren't interested in non-proliferation. They got to defend themselves against India.
I know.
And the Indians aren't interested in non-proliferation. They got to defend themselves against Pakistan.
But this is a good example of how, you know, if we would just appoint me, you know, a ruler of the world, Jim, and I'm sure you'd sign on to that. I mean, my point is, my whole approach to all these policies would have been different for a long time, would be different now, and you've just pointed to something that's very relevant, which is that the problem with Pakistan, as I think we're now beginning to realize, lies to a considerable extent in its relationship to India, right? If we could get a solution there, it would be a lot easier to solve the other problems in Pakistan. And we did not see that kind of holistic approach during the Bush administration.
Like saying, look, if we could get the Israelis and the Palestinians to settle things, that would be nice too. And the Hatfields and the McCoys and the Capitals and the Montagues.
We didn't focus the resources.
You can't do it, Bob. We've been trying.
I know.
You've been trying for 60 years in both Kashmir and Palestine and not getting very far. So, I mean, it seems to me that...
I think our policy has been a disaster. We haven't been trying my approach, Jim. I mean, you know, there's a million things I'd be doing differently. Okay, so if foreign policy continues to be as horribly constructed as it was certainly during the Bush administration and has been during a lot of American history, will we eventually get to a point where I might say, well, look, missile defense is our best hope? Yes, conceivably. But since focusing on it now makes it even more likely that we're going to need it and that the situation will fall apart along these other dimensions, I'm not signing on.
That sounds like
giving up hope.
That sounds like a climb down to me.
From
opposing missile defense. You'll say, well,
missile defense this year, next year, and the year after, okay? I don't want any money spent on it. How clear is that?
If you don't get your way, we'll have to have... And so what you're saying is you're going to wait 2 or 3 years to see if you get appointed president of the world. And if you don't, then we're going to have missile defense. That's the way I heard you say. That's what I heard you say.
Do you think that's too ambitious, Joe? Because... Now that you're on
but you do agree. You do agree. So we agree the bailout stinks, and you agree that Obama's attempt to rhetorically ban nuclear weapons is misplaced. So what else do we agree on?
Wow, I didn't even realize we agreed on all that. But we're
and you agree missile defense is inevitable. So that's three that we agree on.
No, I do not agree.
Yes, you do. You do.
I do not.
I'll amend that. You agree missile defense is inevitable unless you're declared dictator of the world.
No, I think the Obama administration is bringing real hope on the foreign policy front. And
Do you support the build-up in Afghanistan?
You know, you are good at picking these unfortunate examples. I honestly don't know whether that's a bad idea or not. There's a lot of things I support. I liked him going to Turkey and winning hearts and minds there.
Turkey going to the European Union?
On balance, I think it's. Okay. I don't think it's easy. I think it's dicey. But
let me ask you a question about.
I think it's worth a gamble.
Except the Europeans are opposed.
Well, yeah, I know. If they don't like it, it won't happen.
Suppose Bush 43, I made a list here, had asked his fellow allies at the G20 for more troops for Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
More stimulus package for Europe. Turkey getting into NATO, and then asked for a UN resolution denouncing North Korea, and then Bush, just to top it off, Bush had thought that the quote Austrian unquote was a language. If Bush had done all those things, true or false, you think the media would have creamed him for being a moron?
Actually, I don't think some of those things I think are not at all kind of hot button issues. I don't think the media has a strong view on Turkey and
EU. The pushback. I mean, saying that if Bush had done all those things, asked politely, hat in hand, and gotten a thunderous no, do you think the media would have said this was a failed trip for President Bush 40 in his third term?
Well, I don't think he got nothing but thunderous no's. I mean, I think the beginning of the trip was G20. He got a little more there than people thought. He got a much more substantial infusion of funds into the IMF than people thought, which is a kind of global fiscal stimulus. He was more he's apparently, as a result of that, more open to regulation of hedge funds in a way that maybe even you would like. So I thought G20 was a success. I thought some of the other stuff wasn't so much a matter of policy as indeed of atmospherics. I mean, in fact, let me mention a where was this? I think the Washington Post piece, but they quote Tom Donnelly of AEI saying, you know, in reference to how widely liked he manifestly was on this trip overseas, says people already liked Obama. That's nothing new. And at some point, there needs to be a therefore clause. The president already had the world's goodwill, but he has yet to translate that into action for the public good, especially on the security issue. I maintain that a lack of goodwill is a security problem. Okay, and in an age when terrorism is a real problem, then for every, you know, several million people who hate America, you know, a few dozen highly motivated and reasonably smart ones will become formidable terrorists. So I just think that you shouldn't just look for concrete policies that get implemented. If he makes more of the world like us, that is a gain for America's national security.
Bob, I agree with you. How about
okay,
that?
Well, good. Well, then you'll concede when he goes over there and does a successful rock star tour, that's good, right?
But I'm saying if Bush had said that Austrian was a language,
yeah.
the New York Times would still be cackling about it.
I think Obama may get more of a break on some of that kind of stuff, yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, for one thing, Bush had built up a long and formidable record, you know, of saying stupid things. I mean, another thing is, I think...
Could be media bias, perhaps?
No, you could call it that. I think a couple of things, though. The Bush era was so unfortunate in terms of how we are perceived that there's a strong desire for Obama to succeed on this very front. And, yeah, I don't doubt that changes the way these things are played in the media. But on the other hand, it's also the case that he was over there playing in front of a foreign audience. If he plays well over there, if they don't make a big deal of the fact that he thinks Austrian is a language or gave a queen an iPod, it's really not such a big issue, okay?
I don't think it was a big issue that Dan Quayle didn't know how to spell potato. But it was a huge issue at the time. You remember that.
Yeah, but he really was dumb, Jim. Come on.
I'm not convinced Obama's that smart, I got to tell you. I know I'm supposed to think he is, but I'm not sure I believe it.
I just think he's a lot smarter than Bush. And that's enough for me right now. But I also think there's a little bit of... I think during a period of acute financial crisis, I think leaders get granted a little bit of a break. Somewhat the way Bush was given breaks right after 9/11. When there's a sense of crisis, leaders are given breaks.
Except Warren G. Harding, who couldn't get a break.
You identify with him.
I don't identify with him. Not at all. But the point is, I'm just saying that if you forgive scandal in the name of economic growth... Or you forgive bad leadership in the name of crisis? Well, then you really have opened the door
leadership.
To all sorts of. Well, I mean, you said it stinks, and the biggest thing going on right now is the bailout. And you said it stinks.
I didn't say the bailout stinks. I think I said what stinks was.
Oh, stop! Can we get Blogging Hands High Command to rewind the tape here?
Rewind the tape. You rewind the tape. I've got one of my assistants on the case.
All the minions surrounding me here.
Yeah. No. Other tape. Yeah, this tape.
And no brown M&Ms. Anyway.
No, and you. I'm talking to the M&M lady. Actually, somebody's vacuuming. That would be the vacuum lady. Okay. Didn't get the memo, I guess.
Okay.
So we agree. Obama's a great leader. So you were not at all. So his success on the world stage did not make you ever prouder to be an American, Jim. I was proud to be an American, which is not unusual, not for the first time.
I'm proud to be an American too. I always am. I think that fortunately the Europeans are smart enough to ignore Obama on dopey stimulus packages that just print money. Fortunately, the Europeans are smart enough to ignore him on letting Turkey into the European Union. I can't really blame them for not getting enthused about plunging deeper into Afghanistan. And I think that vaporous rhetoric, notwithstanding, the realistic powers of the world will not denuclearize in the face of people who will obviously lie, cheat, and steal on their end of the deal if they sign it at all, including the likes of Iran and Syria and North Korea and China, whoever else.
Are you in favor of like bombing Iran or something? You just want to build missile defense really fast?
I think the Iranians are going to wind up with nuclear weapons and missiles, no matter what we do, including bomb them, in 5 years. I think if we or the Israelis were to bomb them, and I don't think we will, and I'm pretty sure we won't, but if we were, they'd simply figure out some way to get them from Pakistan or Russia or something like that. So in other words, I think that the world we're looking at is distinctly kind of non-zero here.
That would be zero then.
Yeah, right? It's going to be a dangerous world, and we should be ready for it. And that includes defending ourselves. And I think that the hostility to missile defense is a holdover from the Cold War, when the left was sort of happy enough to see the Soviets kind of keep us in check.
And the same
knee-jerk impulse about SDI, fulfilled some Cold War scenario 30 years ago.
I think you've got it exactly backwards.
No sense.
I think you got it exactly backwards. I think, if anything, missile defense would make more sense in the Cold War, because then the gravest threat to our security would be incoming missiles. I think the most likely way that a nuke is going to go off in the United States is, you know, deliver, as the old saying goes, smuggle it across the border in a bale of marijuana.
So you're for the Patriot Act?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that.
Oh, you're not?
Because I don't know enough about it. But
so you're just against it because the New York Times is against it?
No, I just don't. I just don't know the details.
The people who study this matter say this is one way to keep the A bomb from getting across the border.
Okay, fine. But my point, let me finish the point. The point is just that if you think as I do, that a missile is not the likely way a nuke is going to get delivered to the United States, then missile defense makes much less sense than it would in a world where that was the likely way, as was the case in the Cold War.
But I certainly agree that missile defense is not the only solution. Although, as long as countries are building offensive missiles, including certified bad actors like the North Koreans and the Iranians, then if they think it's a good idea to have missile offense, I think we should think it's a good idea to have missile defense. Although I certainly agree, I certainly support the Patriot Act. I support building a wall across the border, because I do agree that we need a lot more strenuous security in ports and so on. Those are the real issues for actually defending the country. And again, I would even go further to say that I think if Obama were smart enough to be for those things, it would be good for the economy. It would stimulate growth and stimulate technological development. I mean, where did the integrated circuit came from? It came from the missile program in the 50s and 60s. And so as we develop these things that would save our lives in millions, we'd also be getting all these spin-offs that would help the economy here at home. As was true in the Cold War. The Internet was a defense program. The greatest technological invention of our lives.
The Internet would have happened anyway. I'm a believer in convergent technological evolution, which is comparable to convergent biological evolution. Like the number of different times eyesight has been invented by evolution. I think certain things were just... In fact, you mentioned the microchip. That was invented independently by two people. Only one was in Silicon Valley, which may be the example you were thinking of.
I said the integrated circuit. I mean, that's an interesting point. And, I mean, if I were more conversant in these scientific issues, I would, be better able to keep up with you on those things. But all I do know is that a great many of the electronics advances that we take for granted now in our consumer lives came out of the Pentagon or DARPA.
Yeah, but my own view is that tends to just hasten things a little, if anything. And I mean, I difference of philosophy. I'm sure that something like the Internet would have gotten invented. And in fact, there were these private sector versions of it. Even during its early phase, we were not really aware of it, but there were these things like CompuServe, remember? And do you remember these things?
The Internet goes back to the 60s. CompuServe was the 80s.
But I don't think CompuServe piggybacked on the Internet, did it? It was a dial-in.
Okay. I don't want to say anymore because I just plain don't know. But I think that it would be a hard sell to imagine that CompuServe and Prodigy and all those things from the late 80s and early 90s or anything other than...
I think they would have merged...
offsprings of...
I don't think so. I don't think they were part of the Internet. I don't. I think it just used the phone system. You dialed in, and you were into this database that allowed you to communicate with other people. The email was not part of them, but there was private sector email. Now, that may have used the Internet, but there was something called MCI mail or Sprint. One of the carriers offered email back before most of us had email proper. Anyway.
This is an interesting point. I hope that you put a link on this. I'd be curious, too, if you've studied this issue of conversion, technological evolution. I like that phrase. It sounds kind of knowing. So I want to be able to throw it around, too. So please provide a link for me and all the other
Well, I mean, in Non-Zero, I document a lot of examples of it going back to ancient times and up to modern times. It's a big part of the argument on the inevitability of globalization.
The inevitability of globalization. That's obvious. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, what was inevitable is that we'd get to the point we are now. Now there is a real chance we'll screw it all up and collapse into the Dark Ages. But you have a couple of contingency plans. One of them is to fly into outer space, I know, but there's a... Well, this is not quite a contingency plan for that, but you wanted to talk about this thing.
Well, it was interesting.
Seasteading. Homesteading, but
right,
S-E-A-steading.
Right. There's a fellow named Patry, P-A-T-R-I, not Patrick, but Patry Friedman, who, curiously enough, is Milton Friedman's grandson, who's a Silicon Valley engineer. I think he works at Google, who has an idea for what he calls seasteading, as homesteading only with S-E-A, as in oceans. Mm-hmm. And he was at the Cato Institute yesterday talking about his idea for creating floating cities as sort of libertarian alternatives living under governments here at home.
So people unhappy with the nation state they were in could, in theory, go buy a floating thing somewhere in the ocean and would be free to live their lives as they saw fit.
Right, right. And although there was a fair amount of pushback, including from a fellow at the Cato Institute, a very smart guy named Doug Bondo, B-A-N-D-O-W, mm-hmm, who said, look, you know, under the law of the Sea Treaty, these things would probably be covered by that. And it would be very hard to imagine that these things would actually achieve sovereignty out there in the ocean, which means that if they didn't, they could then be grabbed by pirates or by some government or something like that. So there's a great deal of skepticism, I think, under the surface, although the enthusiasm among sort of the libertarian crowd at the Hayek Auditorium for this, but then the practicalities of, okay, if you put yourself out in the ocean, how do you avoid, you know, environmental rules and people accuse you of, you know, narcotics or, you know, pornography, or pollution, and once you get under that suspicion, justified or not, then somebody's going to come and inspect you, and then the next thing you know, you're right back in the government ambit again.
But in your ideal world, there wouldn't be the jurisdiction to compel inspection, right? You consider that just an unfortunate feature of a world in which, like, international law is starting to take hold, right?
Well, no, I think international law is a good idea. I support international law. Mm-hmm. I don't support the International Criminal Court, but I support the idea of international law.
You can support the Law of the Sea Treaty?
No, of course not. I mean, the Law of the Sea Treaty is idiotic bureaucrats who want to take over the world and control our resources. And no, I strongly oppose that. I said international law. Remember, international law doesn't need to be codified. It could just be international law.
Right, I mean is it your view that in the ideal world as you would construct it, which had certain kinds of international law but not the Law of Sea Treaty, blah, 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 would these things indeed be able to achieve some degree of sovereignty? Do you think that should be possible if all the laws in the world made sense?
I think it would be nice, but I would put it in sort of the category of a lot of what I think you're thinking, which is it would be great. If I could make it work, it would be a great idea, but since I can't make it work, it won't happen, therefore it's not such a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
I actually asked Patry Friedman a question, and I said, look, you know, what you're talking about here is the old intellectual distinctions made by a sociologist. I know you and I, Bob, have talked about in the past, Albert O. Hirschman, who almost 40 years ago now wrote a book called Exit Loyalty and Voice, in which he said, you know, when you're confronted with a situation you don't like, you can be loyal to it, or, mm-hmm, you know, just accept it. You can protest against it, or you can exit from it.
Vote with your feet.
Vote with your feet, and you know the Rhode Island colony, you know, as a religious dissenters, a great many of the people who came to America were dissenters, and so on and so on. And so that distinction there is valid and useful, and what you're trying to have on the oceans is your own form of exit. You're voting mm-hmm. with your feet or voting with your fins, as it were. And I think the problem, though, is that just the ocean doesn't give you enough distance from the people you're trying to get away from to make it practical. If you're floating around the ocean somewhere and America or the Chinese or some very ambitious bunch of pirates can just sink you with a single torpedo or cruise missile, then you really haven't achieved very much.
The pirates is, in a way, the most interesting question to me. I mean, let's suppose you could get all sovereign nations to agree that there was this realm in which people were allowed to do this to the extent that they did not injure the interests of nation states around the world, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Still, what do you do about, like, just bad guys? Because presumably, one thing the nation states wouldn't do is extend you some protection. If you wanted to opt out of the whole system, fine. But then who do you come running to when a bunch of pirates board your plank and say,
Exactly. Is that what he actually said? They have the capacity to defend themselves, so they have their own little cruise missiles.
That's going to eat up a lot of your resources
exactly.
If you've got like 50 people on a raft and you've got to be able to fend off pirates. I would suggest you spend all of your time building armaments. You know?
Exactly. I agree with you, Bob. And so my point was, I said, listen, I said it's also the case that the history of exploration in the New World, as to say North and South America, was really not. I mentioned Rhode Island and the Puritans and so on. I mean the Pilgrims, but for every religious dissenter who came to America seeking religious freedom, there was somebody else, maybe more, who was seeking plunder, and often they were sponsored by the government. To wit, the entire Spanish conquistador program. They were a government operation designed to enrich Ferdinand and Isabella, and there are plenty of them in the American South too, who came not because they were trying to get away from anything, but because they were the second son of the Duke of Wessex and simply wanted a colony of their own, so they could have South Carolina or whatever. And so I think that the history there is a little different. Because I said the example, what I still think is the only way to make this work is to go to space. And, of course, in space, you probably would need the government doing it, just paying for it. And then if you were to colonize the moon, Mars, and Europa, and wherever else around the solar system, you would have the kind of diversity of political systems and the kind of choice and the implicit threat of exit, because you really would be far away, that you're much more likely to make it work. And so the example I use is Robert Heinlein's famous novel, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, which is about the states of the world, one way or another, finance a very substantial colony on the moon, and then the lunar colony rebels and creates mm-hmm. a libertarian utopia up there. I think that's a much more plausible scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So I call it space-steading as opposed to sea-steading.
Yeah. Now, I know you're in favor of that. It is a little more expensive, as you note.
It is expensive. You're right. In a world that's going to be, especially if we live in now the Bob Wright nightmare world of 50 countries with nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, because you're sort of holding your breath waiting to become dictator of the world, we don't get adequately defend ourselves.
I didn't say dictator. I said
All right. If we can't have missile defense until you're satisfied that there's no chance that you'll become ruler of the world, then this will be a very dangerous world indeed. And so that's only further accelerates my enthusiasm for somebody going to space so that we can get away from jerks with missiles and A-bombs.
Okay. I mean, I do think the political problem you have with your project. I mean, look, in the long run, I expect if we survive long enough, space will be colonized. It would take so much resources right now to kind of do it. I mean, I think a political problem you face is that most people look at this and go, wait a second, you're not talking about saving me or my children in the event of apocalypse. The most you're hoping for is we get like 100 Americans up there who then start reproducing, or 100, you know. So I don't see the political appeal of your program especially. I think it almost assumes much more kind of generosity and selflessness.
Well, no, I think that you're right. There's that element of it, and there's sort of the Noah's Ark scenario. But I think there's also the legitimate military concern, and this is my own view, is that the best way to get this done is an arms race in space. Where the Chinese and the Americans and the Indians and the Japanese.
Jim, if there's one subject you shouldn't bring up when the clock reads 59 minutes and 45 seconds, it's your advocacy of an arms race in space, okay? We're going to have to save that one for another day, buddy. And I don't know.
We'll have to go to the premium space on Blogging Heads to continue this conversation.
That's right. You're not going to watch the rest of this for free, folks, because you know why? It ain't happening. Okay, so I guess we should. The seasteading thing is fascinating.
It was fascinating, and I encourage everybody to. He has some interesting. Cato Unbound is a subset of the Cato Institute's website, and he does make some interesting points about like health care. In other words, can you do some certain high end specialized things? But again, you're not really talking about de-sovereignty-ing things. You're simply talking about fancy hospital cruise ships.
The other question is, can you indeed sever your interconnectedness with the rest of the world? For example, are you going to have internet access via satellite? Now, maybe you don't want it. Maybe you don't want to communicate with anybody else. But once you get on the internet, you have the capacity to do damage to people in other countries, and to that extent, they have a legitimate interest in how you behave on the internet, and right there, you're kind of stepping into a legitimate regulatory framework.
Exactly. Anything to do with trade, anything to do with imports, exports. I mean, that's what Doug was saying in his comments on his. So, but it's again, it's a, and I really sort of believe that Friedman's idea is kind of more of a critique of statism than an actual plausible plan. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's like Plato's Republic. It's kind of a metaphor.
Like 10 years ago or something, I'm pretty sure there's a piece in Wired about some people who are doing something like this. Maybe they had found an island that wasn't claimed. But they were doing it, and I think the whole idea was to be that their computers would be free from anyone's regulation. They were gonna—I forget, maybe.
There's a lot of South Pacific islands that have one time or another been thought about this, and they even tried to think about doing it inside the United States. Pick one state here in America, and fill it up with libertarians and see what happens. But
I think they should. I think you should start one and call it Pinkistan or something. And the Pinkistanis.
No, I'm just going to call it Fox Nation.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll look at Fox Nation. And
all right, wonderful.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been nice talking to you.
It has been, as always.
Okay.
So
all right.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.